Hello there. Today is Monday, December the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, North Korea again ramps up its nuclear ambitions, as well as the rhetoric between its leader and President Trump.
I think the denuclearization offer was a sham, that it was an attempt by Kim to buy time and to buy recognition, which he certainly got.
Marking 6 months of protests, hundreds of thousands of people packed the streets of Hong Kong Sunday. Also ahead, after a year of monumental accolades, Taylor Swift heads toward the holidays with a song for the season. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korea carried out what its state media says is a very important test at its Sohae satellite launch site on Sunday. That is the rocket testing ground that U.S. officials once said North Korea had promised to close. The reported test comes as a year-end deadline that North Korea has imposed nears, warning it could take a new path amid stalled denuclearization talks with the United States. The KCNA News report called it a successful test with great significance, but did not specify what was tested. Tensions have been ramping up as the deadline approaches, and North Korea calls on the United States to change its policy of insisting Pyongyang's unilateral denuclearization, and it is also demanding relief from punishing sanctions. My colleague Steve Miller asks Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation, if this is actually a change in what the North has been doing.
My sense has been that denuclearization talks have been off the table since Singapore. Kim Jong-un has perceived that he didn't need to give up anything. By my estimate, since he offered to denuclearize in March of last year, he's roughly doubled his nuclear destructive potential of his nuclear arsenal. He's not surrendered a single nuclear weapon to show good faith. He's not eliminated any production capability or even halted production. I think the denuclearization offer was a sham, that it was an attempt by Kim to buy time and to buy recognition, which he certainly got.
So what is the next avenue of opportunity to address North Korea's growing nuclear arsenal and growing missile capabilities?
I think we have to recognize that Kim Jong-un has provided us the perfect context. He keeps insisting on corresponding measures. Well, in my mind, corresponding measures to doubling his nuclear destructive potential is increasing the sanctions. Now, it takes the UN, in most cases, to do anything serious there, but the thing we haven't done very seriously at this point is stop the ship-to-ship illicit transfers. And I think that's the kind of thing that either unilaterally working in the Yellow/West Sea or working with the Chinese in that area, we wouldn't have to stop every ship. We'd only have to stop some selected ones and seize them to cause a lot of that activity to grind to a halt. And that would, I believe, really hurt North Korea. So I think there are some actual sanction-related activities that we already have a legal basis for that we could initiate.
U.S. President Donald Trump signaled that military options have never really been off the table, but this is also coming at a time when cost-sharing and burden-sharing discussions are underway with South Korea, and the United States has put forward a reported ask of $5 billion that South Korea has essentially balked at. What kind of situation does that create in terms of a response either from the United States or South Korea, should there be any more provocative actions from North?
Well, I think that while President Trump is asking for more money from the South Koreans, what he's really concerned about is the future. He's worried that great power conflict is potentially far more likely in the future, and none of us, neither South Korea nor the United States, have invested in producing military capabilities to adequately deter that threat. So I think what he's trying to do is to cause both of our countries to increase our capabilities. Now, he's asked for it as burden sharing, but it's not clear to me whether that's an absolute demand or whether that's a way of saying, look, we both need to be increasing our capabilities. You need to put more money into your capabilities. We need to put more in ours. Let's work out a deal for doing that.
The clock is, of course, ticking towards the end of the year, which is what the deadline Pyongyang has put for the resumption of talks and for the United States to adopt a more congenial attitude that Pyongyang is looking for. We've seen the launch at Sohae. We've seen some other short-range tests in recent weeks, 13 missile launches this year. What do you foresee North Korea doing in the weeks leading up to December 31st and ultimately January 1st, when we expect yet again to have Kim Jong-un's New Year address?
You remember in 2017 that President Trump came in and proposed and started carrying out a maximum pressure campaign. Ironically, that's what Kim Jong-un is doing. He's doing an escalated maximum pressure campaign, so he's been gradually increasing the pressure. He began in May with some missile launches, saw that the U.S. did not seriously object to those, and therefore has continued the escalation process with many more missile launches this year, but they have been predominantly short range. Now we expect to see some longer range missile launches. Kim may well transition to an ICBM launch, though probably not until spring or summer next year after he's done other intermediate range launches. He may also transition to a nuclear weapon test. We don't know for sure what is in his plan, but it is clearly intended to increase pressure on the United States, hoping that that pressure alone, rather than offering any form of serious concession, will get the U.S. to make major concessions to North Korea. And I think from a political perspective, that doesn't stand well for President Trump. He's got to be prepared to take a more proactive response to North Korea.
Does the fact that this latest satellite test was conducted at Sohae, which was partially dismantled as a good faith measure by North Korea, signal Pyongyang's willingness to take things in a new direction and a more forceful direction?
They've certainly threatened a new path, which is interpreted apparently as a more escalated approach against the United States. So sure, they're prepared to do that. But they're prepared to do that as long as the United States poses no retaliation or no escalation against them. I think that the key is we are not taking serious action to deter North Korea. Simply talking and saying military options are on the table is not adequate.
International Edition Steve Miller speaking with Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst with the RAND Corporation. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Iran's president has presented what he calls a budget to resist sanctions to Parliament Sunday and suggests a possible multi-billion-dollar loan from Russia would be a key source of revenue. Russian and Syria regime's forces have stepped up their attacks on the rebel stronghold in Idlib. How taking care of bees is keeping U.S. veterans grounded. And California debates the future of Uber and Lyft drivers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The FBI on Sunday confirmed that the shooter at a U.S. Army or Navy base in Pensacola, Florida, Friday was a 21-year-old Saudi Air Force officer who was a student at the Naval Aviation School's command at the base. The agency says it has yet to determine the motive for the shooting spree, but it is investigating it as an act of terrorism. VOA's Slatika Hoke reports the Saudi government has pledged to fully cooperate with the investigation.
Three Naval Academy students were killed and eight other people were injured after Al-Shamrani opened fire Friday morning at the Naval Air Academy in Pensacola. Officials say the three were killed while trying to stop the shooter and that their action saved lives of many others. The FBI said Sunday the investigators are still working to determine the shooter's motive.
While there are many reports circulating regarding the shooter's motivation and his alleged activities leading to his attack, I can tell you that we are looking very hard at uncovering his motive, and I would ask for patience so we can get this right.
Investigators also are trying to determine if the Saudi officer acted alone or as part of a terrorist plot.
We are, as we do in most active shooter investigations, work with the presumption that this was an act of terrorism. This allows us to take advantage of investigative techniques that can help us more quickly identify and then eliminate any additional potential threats to the rest of our community.
The FBI thanked the Saudi government for its pledge of full and complete cooperation. U.S. President Donald Trump said Friday that King Salman of Saudi Arabia had called him to express his condolences.
The king said that the Saudi people are greatly angered by the barbaric actions of the shooter, and that this person in no way, shape, or form represents the feelings of the Saudi people who love the American people so much.
News media reported that the shooter, who was also killed in the incident, had hosted a dinner party days before the shooting, where he showed videos of mass shootings to his guests. He also visited New York City recently. No arrests have been made in the case, but several Saudi students who knew al-Shamrani have been restricted to the base by their commanding officer and are cooperating with investigators. The shooting at the Pensacola Naval Air Station is the second deadly shooting at a U.S. naval facility this week. A U.S. sailor shot three civilians at a base in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, Wednesday, killing two of them before committing suicide. Acting Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said he had ordered a review of the Department of Defense's security and vetting policies. Zlarissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Vast crowds of black-clad demonstrators thronged Hong Kong on Sunday in the largest anti-government protest since local elections last month that boosted the pro-democracy movement seeking to curb controls by China. Chants of fight for freedom and stand with Hong Kong echoed as demonstrators, from students to professionals to the elderly, marched from Victoria Park in the bustling shopping district towards the financial area.
We see they try to set roadblocks and try to intimidate not only the participants of the rally, but also journalists in Central. And even they humiliated some of us with our backgrounds. So this is unacceptable, and we need to tell the police that they should behave and enforce the law in a professional manner.
The former British colony of 7.4 million people reverted to Chinese rule in 1997. It is governed under a one-country, two-systems formula, guaranteeing freedoms not allowed in mainland China, but many fear Beijing is tightening the screws. House Democrats worked through the weekend as they sped toward articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. The House Judiciary Committee begins new hearings today. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
House Democrats worked through the weekend, speeding towards articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. Democrats say the charges are likely to focus on abuse of power and obstruction of the congressional inquiry. The case is centered around President Trump's July 25th phone call, in which he asked Ukraine's president for a favor in investigating Democrats, as he withheld nearly $400 million in military aid. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
Anybody who is looking for a smoking gun should look directly at the President of the United States. He is the smoking gun.
Republican Matt Gaetz disagrees.
I think the President was acting on a sincere, longly held view and skepticism of foreign aid. I think he was acting on concern about Ukraine being the third most corrupt country in the world.
He appeared on ABC's This Week. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Well, joining us now to discuss the arguments and political pitfalls of impeaching a president is Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. So thank you for being with us, Professor. Republicans say this is going way too fast and there's really no justification for the entire process. Democrats, on the other hand, are charging that U.S. democracy depends on this. Are they exaggerating?
I think it would have been helpful for them to explain why the rule of law is so critical to maintaining a democracy. It is critical because if we run our government by the mere power of men, then those individuals are not constrained in any way by law. What the rule of law means, what living in a rule of law society means, is that power is constrained at all times by law, so that the exercise of power on the part of the president, on the part of other executive branch officials, and even on the part of Congress takes place entirely according to rules, laws, and moral practices that help determine what ways people can act and what ways it is forbidden for them to act. And if you don't have a mechanism for holding individuals accountable for violating those laws, then you no longer have a rule of law society. Therefore, you no longer have a democracy.
If, as the Republicans claim, that this is a futile effort, that the Democrats are going to vote to impeach, it's going to move into the Senate, and the Senate is not going to vote to remove the president, and if he does, in fact, or if he doesn't, in fact, get removed, then was it a futile effort that was not worth putting the country through?
Democrats were very worried about that, and as you know, Democrats were divided about whether or not it would be futile if they could not remove the president. In my view, it is not futile. Because in order to repair rule of law damage, it's necessary to use legal processes like impeachment or in other cases like conviction so that we know that we are correcting through the processes set out in our constitutional framework damage that has occurred. If we don't impeach in the face of crimes of this magnitude and an abuse of office of this magnitude, then we are saying that it is permissible for all future presidents to do this. If the Democrats are successful in impeaching the president, even if he's not removed, there is at least a piece of restoration of the rule of law in that act. And it signals to future presidents that if they use the presidency for personal and private gain, and if they are corrupt in their motives in engaging in foreign policy, they may be impeached. In another composition of Congress, they may also be removed.
Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. South Africa's tax authority recently destroyed more than $500,000 worth of imported goods, including more than 13,000 bales of clothing, just as many South Africans are staring down a tight holiday season and a sluggish economy. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell looks into the logic behind the move.
It seems like a tragedy. The destruction of a veritable mountain of imported clothes, shoes, and accessories worth more than $500,000. The mountain of clothes was a tragedy, says Patrick Moyang, the executive for customs investigations in the South African Revenue Service. Just not in the way that many South Africans see it.
We have noticed over a period of time since about 2006, even earlier than that, 2001, that there have been a negative impact which was brought about by the proliferation of cheap clothing items into the market, which led to the closure of a number of manufacturing firms that were responsible for employing a number of people. So many people lost their jobs, and those firms, when they close down, you are not able to create new employment, which actually leads to a spiraling effect of a number of different ills that the society faces and so on.
Now for the math portion of the story. South Africa has long struggled with high unemployment, hitting an unprecedented level of 29% this year. Also this year, the nation's manufacturing sector shrank by nearly 4%. What that adds up to for a lot of struggling South Africans is outrage that the authorities couldn't just, say, give the clothes away, or at least let people have access to cheap clothes. Many items in the latest haul, Moyang says, were perfectly usable. They included children's clothes, shoes, and blankets. Tracy Gilmore was also familiar with those dismal numbers when she founded the Clothing Bank, a business training project, in 2010. The nationwide program takes in some 2 million pieces of unsold or returned clothing items each year from major South African retailers. But surprisingly, she says she supports destruction of the seized clothing. She explains.
The South African retail industry creates 16 million jobs, and counterfeit clothing destroys jobs. So it's a really difficult conversation. It's a very difficult topic because we do have a huge poverty problem in South Africa. But you can't endorse illegal activities. You can't accept that. And I mean, how would one reasonably redistribute all of that stock?
Other African countries have also taken seemingly counterintuitive steps to protect local industry. In 2016, the East African nations of Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda hiked tariffs on imports of secondhand clothing. The U.S. retaliated with threats to existing trade deals, causing Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda to ease their stance. But Rwanda has stood firm on its refusal to back down, saying the cheap imported clothes are hurting local manufacturing. Moeng says jobs are ultimately more important than cheap clothes, and notes that South African retailers produce a wide range of locally made garments. He also says that when authorities tried to give away the seized clothing, they ran into more problems.
We used to donate such goods to the non-government organizations that are responsible for distributing those goods to the needy of our country and things like that. But there was a procedure that needed to be followed with regard to that. But as a result of the challenges and the risk that we have identified through the distribution or the donation of those items into the NGOs, we found out that such goods do not find their ways to the needy people where they were supposed to be going.
And so, as the holidays approach and the seized clothes emerge from the shredder, South Africans are being asked what they really want. A cheap shirt or a strong economy? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Musician Juice WRLD has died after a medical emergency at a Chicago airport Sunday. He was only 21 years old. AP music correspondent Margie Sarzaletta has the story.
The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office confirms the death of Juice WRLD, real name Jared A. Higgins. Police and fire officials say a 21-year-old male had a medical emergency at Chicago's Midway International Airport Sunday morning. He was transported to an area hospital where he was pronounced dead. Fire officials say the man suffered cardiac arrest. Juice WRLD's biggest hits were Lucid Dreams and Bandit. Margie Zaraletta, Chicago.
Well, the recent film release, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, by Mariel Heller, is based on the Esquire magazine article, Can You Say Hero?, that award-winning journalist Tom Junod wrote in 1998 about Fred Rogers, the American TV personality who spoke to children and advocated empathy, understanding, and reconciliation. The newly released film shows how two polar opposites, an empathetic Mr. Rogers and a cynical writer, became friends. Some have said the movie makes them want to be better people. Conversely, Todd Phillips' Joker, a billion box office hit, offers a dark portrait of Batman's nemesis thriving on rancor, revenge, and social chaos. VOA's Penelope Pulu looks at the two contrasting messages.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero. No, not at all.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is based on a true story of how a cynical journalist hiding childhood trauma meets beloved television personality Mr. Rogers for an Esquire magazine profile about heroes.
Everyone, this is Lloyd Vogel. He is a wonderful writer.
Matthew Rhys plays award-winning journalist Lloyd Vogel, who receives an obligatory assignment to cover Fred Rogers. Following the initial meeting between the two men, they go on to develop a deep friendship. Through kindness and insight, Mr. Rogers, played by Tom Hanks, helps Vogel heal from his trauma.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
I started looking at many, 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 many hours of the half hour of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I read the scripts, his handwritten scripts of the shows. But rather than try to go with a microscopic mole for mole imitation of Fred Rogers, it was a cadence, a quietness, a slowness.
We'll just take a minute and think about all the people who loved us into being.
Critics say Tom Hanks's presence and his uncanny interpretation of Mr. Rogers is as healing as the television personality himself. Many forecast an Oscar nomination for the two-time Academy Award-winning actor.
My neighbor.
Tom Junod, the real-life journalist on whom Vogel's character is based, says our world, steeped in aggression and incivility, needs a reminder of Mr. Rogers' message of friendship and reconciliation.
We have decided to move, you know, forward, without a lot of the qualities that Fred embodied, without kindness, without mercy. Like, do we really want to be looking at Fred Rogers in the rearview mirror? Do we really want to leave this kind of example behind?
A recent poll about civility in America shows that 65% of Americans consider incivility in the workplace, social media, and public places a serious concern.
Action.
And although A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood has performed reasonably well at the box office, grossing about $25 million since its release, it is nowhere near the billion-dollar box office triumph of the movie Joker, a character drama by Todd Phillips. Joaquin Phoenix has received Oscar buzz for his portrayal as Batman's anti-hero, the Joker, a homicidal sociopath who triggers chaos and killings in the already divided city of Gotham.
Or is it getting crazier out there?
Critics and audiences are divided over Joker. Some recognize Joaquin Phoenix's artful portrayal of a marginalized man's descent into insanity, while others fear that many people will empathize with the lone shooter, leading to copycat acts of social violence. As we head into the Oscars season, it remains to be seen which of the two forces, that of the Joker or that of Mr. Rogers, will prevail. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Please won't you be my neighbor?
That was wonderful.
My winter nights are taken up by static stress.
Well, it took Taylor Swift only 5 days to write her new song for the holidays. It's a cheerful tune in which Swift reminisces about her own family Christmas memories. Her new video of the song is filled with clips of childhood home movies with her father and mother along with her brother. It includes footage of the family opening gifts, playing in the snow, sledding, and just sitting around the Christmas tree.
Bundled up in their mittens and coats and the side overflow. And I just wanna be there tonight. Sweet dreams of holly and ribbon. Mistakes are forgiven. And
you've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Yeah.